You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 26th of July 2019. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and we are broadcasting live tonight at RadioAryan.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, the Greatest Historian Ever Told, Communism by the Backdoor, and the Freemasonic Victors of World War II. National Socialist documentary producer extraordinaire, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, how are you doing today? Is it hot enough for you?
Well, it's hot enough, but people just don't understand the pressure of working with Sven Longshanks. The pressure is unreal. the timing has to be perfect, and one can't even fall asleep 5 minutes before the show.
I'm a harsh slave master, aren't I? I'm a harsh slave master, Dennis.
I can vouch for that one, yeah.
Well, it's a good job I've got an emergency way to get hold of you. But you've been working hard, I hear, very, very hard. I mean, you know, it's not like you're usually, you know, dropping off to sleep during the day, is it? You've been up, been up day and night, toiling away at your next opus.
Well, when the walls of Jericho won't tumble, the walls won't tumble. And I've been tying all week, and we spoke last week about being and that's really away from finishing, and that's really just turned into, it may as well have been a mile. So I still weren't happy with the final outcome the last time we were trying it, which wasn't all that long ago. So hopefully again we'll try again this week. So I apologise for anyone who was waiting for the final episode, but standards have to be kept and walls have to tumble.
Well, I think we've whetted their appetite with last week's podcast and all the information that we went into there. And you're right. You know, if you're going to do a job, you've got to do it properly. You've got to do it to the best of your ability. I mean, that's what I try to do with Radio Aryan. I try to do everything as best as we possibly can, so that you can be proud of it then. So, you know, some of the stuff we put out a couple of years back, I mean, it was to the best of my ability, but when I look at the sound quality now, you know, it's a bit embarrassing.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want that again.
You know, everybody starts somewhere, don't they?
Yeah.
Can't all start at the top, Sven, you know what I mean?
I mean, some of us are blessed to be that good. Well, what have we got? What have we got for tonight?
Listen, can I just say this? You've just reminded me. Apparently, anyway, I got a message from Germany, and I'm no longer thought now of just a speaker of the truth. I am now thought of in, I suppose, as a prophet or a sub archangel. So next week, please, can I have the right introduction?
A prophet.
This is what I've heard: a prophet or an archangel. I've been elevated to that status in Germany, which, of course. I do think.
Yeah, a revealer of the truth. I do think Adolf Hitler was somewhat of a prophet.
Without a doubt, yeah.
Because what he said came true, and I think it says in the Bible that the test of whether a prophet comes from God is whether or not what they say comes true. And what Adolf Hitler said would happen if he lost the war has come true. It's all come true. Yes. And partially, I mean, what we're going to see tonight and what we're going to be discussing tonight is the parallels between what was going on in Germany in 1927 and what's going on today in Europe in 2019. 100 years difference, and we've got the same problems and the same solutions are what's needed. And before we get into this, where did you find this, Dennis? This is a speech by Joseph Goebbels, basically, from 1927 that you've got here.
Yeah, well, he wrote some articles as well for a newspaper, a German newspaper. And as you know, I've up and down the internet, I've come across these things, and there was quite a number of them, and I just thought I'd pick two or three for tonight. And they're quite interesting, you know, because they do ring true to say America even today is in a very similar position, in fact probably gone even more than what Germany has.
Well, yeah, I say a speech there. Actually, it's an essay. It's an essay by Joseph Goebbels, and I did a little bit of digging into the background of it. This was This was first published in the fourth issue of Der Angriff, dated 25th of July, 1927. So you think, well, what is Der Angriff? What does it mean? Well, it means action. And it was the National Socialist newspaper, not like Der Stürmer. It wasn't anti-Semitic caricatures. It was more a sort of a party newspaper, propaganda thing, probably close to what the Nordic Resistance Movement put out. They put out a newspaper. Mm. And I've got a Wikipedia quote on it. And they say the newspaper was set up by Joseph Goebbels, who in 1926 had become the Berlin Gauleiter. The party provided most of the money needed to ensure publication. The paper was first founded to rally NSDAP members during the nearly two-year ban on the party in Berlin. And I think that's interesting because this is the time period we were talking about last week, wasn't it? Mm. Partially.
Yeah.
When they were banned. So this is one of the ways that that they coped with this. They produced a newspaper and tried to get the information out to the people through this newspaper. Der Angriff was conceived as a mass circulation paper that fought the hated system with sensational language. Anti-parliamentarianism and anti-Semitism were its self-defining themes. And that's like a lot of the alt-media today. It's anti-parliamentarian. It exposes Jewish subversion in the media, and also exposes race, basically. So it's a similar sort of thing that the alternative media is engaging in today that was first done by these National Socialists back then. And it's the same when you think, well, they didn't have a party. The party was banned, but they had an alternative media. And we're similar to that way. We don't have a party. Not because they're banned, but we just don't have a political party in Britain. But we do have a good alternative media. Sorry, you were trying to say something there, Dennis.
No, I was just saying, like, it's very similar to how they try and stop people from speaking up today, that obviously they did get banned as well. So this is a method. I think it even went back further, back to the Russian Revolution, where if you can stop people from talking and criticising, then you've got more or less a free rein, which is, as I say, one of the first things to try and do, and we suffer that today.
One of the problems with that, you know, if you stop a man from being able to communicate with his mouth, the only thing he's got left is to communicate with his fists. And if they were to censor the internet and silence all the alternative media, I think that there would be a huge increase in violent actions against the state if they were to do that. Because people would think, well, what other hope have I got? What have I got to lose? And I think it would increase the violence. So I think it's wrong of them to censor the sites when that sort of thing happens. But they just don't seem to be thinking about that. You know, they just want to silence it. They don't seem to be thinking about, well, what is the effect of that? What is the effect of this censorship? Because that is just logical, isn't it? You're going to have to use your hands if you can't use your mouth.
Well, it's like we're in this country anyway. We're kind of restricted anyway because we can only say for satellite TV, we can only have Sky. It's against law for us to get any other means of satellite, which is possible because people, you know, have these things where they have big dishes and they can get more information out of the satellite system. But in Britain, we're outside Europe. We're an island, and we have only a certain amount of information we're allowed to take in. And all that is kind of propaganda. And so, you know, there's 100 and probably 3-4 times the amount of satellites we can't receive because we're not allowed.
Yeah, I think Press TV is one of them. They banned Press TV, didn't they? But I mean, you can still get that online. Yeah. I think they fined Russia today £2 billion or something, a very large amount today for...
Well, that's interesting because there was something the other day where a firm got... find something like £18 million, and they said it as though I should be happy. It's like, but I'm not going to see anything of it. You know, where did it all go?
Yeah, and I think you want to have a plurality of views. What they were saying is, well, this is pro-Russian. Well, you would expect them to be pro-Russian, the same as you would expect Britain to be pro-British. I mean, it's in the name, isn't it? British Broadcasting Corporation and Russia Today. You expect to get the viewpoint of that country. You don't expect it all to be a harmonized viewpoint, which is, you know, that's what the globalists want. the New World Order. It wants this harmonized view that just repeats what they want, the way they see the world.
And RT really is more left-wing than you think, believe it or not. I know I've been watching, I watched a few programs and was surprised just how left-wing it really was, you know, if you really look at it.
Yeah, it is left-wing, but it will still interview some right-wing personalities. That's the difference.
Casey Hopkins was one, but that was a surprise to me because when Casey Hopkins was saying a visit to Russia was, you know, compared to living in Britain, she said was just wonderful, and yet the person interviewing her was kind of, you know, married to a Muslim and saying that that's one of the, you know, least left-wing cities she's ever visited. So you began to get a picture of it all as that interview went on. As much as Katie Hopkins enjoyed her stay in Russia, she was in a left-wing country.
And the grass is always greener. I mean, I think...
A lot of grass in Russia.
I think Viktor Orban's wonderful. And yet, you know, if you talk to people that are actually in Hungary, they'll say, oh, no, he isn't. He's got all his cronies in power and he just says what he says to appeal to, you know, the rest of the nationalists in the world. And they don't think he's any good. But, you know, I guess you always look at how other people have it and think, you know, that wouldn't that be so much better if we had it here? And just before we continue on with this, what do you think of Boris Johnson being voted in and Jacob Rees-Mogg as leader of the House?
I think, he come from the same places where Cameron did. I mean, they were both in that same club, which, you know, were toffs and restaurants and then paid for the damage after. So it comes from that elite class. But what did impress me about him was the fact that he came out with a statement when in his victory speech, when he first got the job, he came out and he named the date that he would be out, Brexit would be done by. And I said to the wife at the time, he's going to come out whether it's a no deal or not. You just don't. You're not that committed. And then the following day, it kind of cleared out the cabinet of everybody who was half-heartedly or even against coming out, and he put in people who he felt would do the job. And that, to me, was a huge step. A lot, you know, a big clear out and getting people in who he thinks will deliver. So I think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful. He got rid of 15 people in all, which is, I think it was the biggest sackings ever. Yeah, but, you know, unfortunately, he left Amber Rudd in there. I wish she'd gone.
And a couple of others, I know.
Yeah, not very pretty Patel. She's now the Home Secretary, and Sajid Javid is Chancellor of the Exchequer. But he did make Jacob Rees-Mogg the leader of the House of Commons, and that was just a masterstroke, absolute major, masterstroke. Yeah, I've watched him doing battle with the rest of them, and you know he's such a cut above the rest, head and shoulders above the rest. He's in this. Back business committee or business committee or something, and now he's leading that. And usually, it normally only has two or three people in the house, and it was packed full of people just to hear him speak because the guy is so witty. And they were saying like, when are we going to have a debate on staying in the customs union? And he was just like, well, why would we want to debate that? And then there was somebody else saying, when are we going to have another debate on leaving the EU? And he was, well, we've done that for the last 3 years. I think the general public are sick to death of that. We won't be having any more of that. Just brilliant.
Well, yeah. I mean, someone was saying like that there's obviously going to be a general election where people could decide. They've already decided. I mean, some people have got banners. Some MPs have got these supporters with banners saying, you know, stop Brexit. Well, if you want to be anti-democratic, well, carry on. But the vote has happened, the people have spoken, and if you believe in so-called democracy, which you keep telling me, then you've got to deliver.
Yeah, I think they will. I think we've actually got the best people that are most likely to deliver it now leading the Conservative Party. How long that will be, as you say, you know, there might very well be a general election very soon because obviously the Labour Party and half the Conservative Party aren't pleased with this, but I certainly am. Yeah, it's looking good for Britain again at last. Well, let's get back to this information under Angriff. The most regular contributors were party functionaries. The lead articles were usually written by the publisher, Goebbels, until 1933, and he signed his articles Dr. G. Willy Krauss, using the pen name Peter Hagen, was its first editor-in-chief. He was succeeded first by Julius Lippert, then in 1933 by Carolee Kampmann, and from 1935 by Goebbels' trusted friend Hans Schwarz von Berg. A further attraction of the paper were the political caricatures by Hans Schweitzer. Now, I looked up Hans Schweitzer, hoping to find some of his cartoons, and I couldn't find any. There was a link to just general National Socialist propaganda posters. And that got me thinking, you know, those posters were really, really well done, and yet I don't know the names of any of these artists that did them. And I thought, well, they'd probably hidden the artists' names because they don't want people, you know, saying what wonderful artwork this guy created. I'd really like to know what Hans Schweitzer's cartoons were like to compare them to today. I mean, we have an artist that designs cartoons for Radio Aryan, Boat Sinker. I think his cartoons are wonderful, really, really funny political cartoons. And I'd like to see what this Hans Schweitzer's are like. So if any of our listeners know where we can find any of these cartoons, please get in touch. The first...
It's funny to say that, because I was searching for a poster, which you're probably quite familiar with, when it shows the Six Nations going into the Soviet Union with a big Bolshevik soldier kicking it across, which is broken, which kind of depicts the Christian invasion of the Soviet Union. I couldn't find it anywhere. I managed to find one that I already had, but I went on the internet, just couldn't find it anywhere.
I struggled to find that. I was looking for that the other day, and I struggled to find it with all the usual search terms, you know, National Socialists against Bolshevism, big Christian cross, Bolshevism, all sorts. It took me a long time to find it. It wouldn't surprise me if they were trying to hide that. It was very easy to find the picture of the dagger stabbing through a Bible with "This is the enemy" written in English. Yeah, it's got to be the most blatant piece of black propaganda there. It's not even written in German.
Yeah.
I'll send you the image that I've got if you're still wanting it after the show, Dennis. Der Angriff was first published on the 4th of July, Independence Day, 1927, by the Angriff Press. Its motto was, "For the oppressed, against the exploiters." At first appearing once a week, then starting 1st of October 1929, twice a week, Der Angriff became a daily newspaper with the subtitle, "The German Evening Paper in Berlin," after the 1st of November 1930. I like that. So they've given it a more easily approvable title, an officialer title, the German Evening Paper of Berlin. After the 1st of October 1932, it was published twice daily as The Attack at Noon and The Night Attack. After the 1st of February 1933, it appeared as the daily newspaper of the German Labour Front from the Eher Press, with Goebbels remaining as the publisher. In 1927, that's when it started, the circulation was around 2,000. That's less listeners than we have at Radio Aryan. But this number rose to 146,694 in 1939 and 306,000 by 1944. So that's a huge increase in 20 years, from 2,000 to 306,000. And it's probably more than that in actual fact. They're probably massaging the figures at Wikipedia. However, after the NSDAP gained political power in Germany on the 30th of January 1933, the importance of the newspaper slowly decreased. When the Allies started the terror bombing campaign against Berlin civilians, the circulation was increased to keep up the morale of the Berliners. After the 19th of February 1945, Der Angriff was merged with the Berlin Illustrated Night Edition, and the last edition was published on the 24th of April 1945. So we've got a long history there of nationalists having their own publications to try and get their information out. You know, that's 100 years ago, pretty much, when they were doing that. And this article here is from, as I say, it's from the fourth edition, and it's called We Demand, written by Joseph Goebbels. He says, the German people is an enslaved people. Under international law, it is lower than the worst Negro colony in the Congo. We have had all sovereign rights taken from us. We are just about good enough for international capital to allow us to fill its money sacks with interest payments, and that, and only that, is all we have to show for a centuries-long history of heroism. Do we deserve this? No, and no again. Therefore, we demand that a struggle against this condition of shame and misery must begin, and that the men in whose hands we put our fate must use every means to break the chains of slavery. And there's a couple of bits in that that I thought were interesting. That last phrase there, breaking the chains of slavery, and that reminded me of the title of Gottfried Feder's book, Manifesto for the Breaking of Financial Slavery to Interest, which shows a slave's hands with chains there, because that's what interest is. That's what usury is. And also, that's what he's pointing out there, is that it's this interest payments. That's where all the money is going.
That's right. Yeah, people don't realise that they are carrying chains. This is the thing. You know, people are walking around thinking they're free, but as the old saying goes, you know, no more enchained than those who think they are free. And that's what the financial system does.
And what he was saying there, their solution to that was the nationalisation of the banks and the removal of usury from them. So there was no more back-breaking usury that had to be paid out. And instead of having it tied to the price of gold and how much gold that the country had, they issued notes that were based on the labour that was needed. Which was which was never really been heard of before, and now all the banks do that. You know, they broke the link with the price of gold. I think after the Second World War, all the banks did this pretty much, because up until that point, they had to have a certain amount of gold. But once the National Socialists did this, it sort of got misused really by these other banks, I think.
Well, I mean, it could be proven it could be done without the gold, but what happened was that I don't think there's any other country in the world got gold, but apart from us now, because I mean, we go around plundering all these other nations. I know Germany were whinging that they didn't have the gold, and America turned around and said, well, we haven't got the gold at Fort Knox, but there is gold down at the Bank of England for sure, so a lot of that were Gaddafi's.
Yes, I think we can make a guess at where all the gold ends up. The people that had lots of gold. This gold standard, that's what it was called, was the gold standard, wasn't it? Everything was based on...
Yeah, which the Rothschilds set every noon or something like that.
Yeah, they set the price of it. And what the National Socialists did, they decoupled their banking system from that, and they decoupled it from the international bankers, and they nationalised it, which meant that they provided the money for the works that needed to be carried out within the country. And they tried to be as self-sufficient as possible so they could pay for things with that and use that money within circulation. And that's absolutely fine. But where it tends to break down a little bit is when you need to do trade with another country, which is where these international bankers and these middlemen come in. So what the way that they solved that was to say, well, we'll do barter. So what we'll do is we'll still use, you know, you could use pound sterling, or you could use the dollar to measure the amount that something is worth. And then they said, but what we'll do is if we want your oil, we'll pay you in our rubber, or we'll pay you in our wheat, or we'll pay you in
whatever they want. Yeah.
Yeah. In whatever they've got. And they'll cut out the middleman. So the middleman's not adding his bit in there. Yeah. And that was a real shocker for the world's banking system. And that was really what they didn't want catching on.
Yeah, because Italy did the same. So all of a sudden, countries around Europe were starting to cut out the middleman, as you say.
And that's what the Jew's always been, is you know, it's been a merchant. He's always been the middleman.
Yeah, living off the profits of others, yeah.
Yeah. And this is what they're pointing out here, is that somebody is taking all this money. And that's the only money that Germany was allowed to earn, was just enough to pay this interest. And they were saying, you look back at our history and you look back at the heroes that we've had, centuries of heroes, and it's all come to this. Is that just? Yeah. Do we deserve this? And he's saying, well, no, they don't deserve this, but who's going to fix it? The only people that can fix this situation are the Germans themselves. They can't look to the UN to do it, or the League of Nations, or America. And it's the same today. You know, we've got to start doing things for ourselves. And that is why I support Brexit, because, you know, even if it's just on paper, at least there's a semblance of doing things for ourselves instead of relying on other people and sticking to their laws. Because, you know, in everything, if you don't look out for your own interests, nobody else is going to do that for you. You have
no
to go
one's
out
work
and,
on a limb. No.
No, well, you have to go out and earn the money to pay for the roof over your head, to pay for your food, to pay for everything. You have to go out and earn that. You can't say, well, we're going to put somebody else's needs ahead of our own. We're going to make sure they're all right first. It doesn't
work.
Well,
the thing is, with this country, what's slightly different is that there are a certain amount of people who are born into privilege, whose life, once they're born, is plotted for them, whereas, you know, they've no real need to work, and this privilege lasts a lifetime, while others in this country are not as fortunate and have to go through the ups and downs of unemployment and illness and everything else what follows, whereas some people in this country do have a privilege just from being born.
Well, that's where nationalism is so important, because if you've got an upper class of people that are just born like that with money, and they're taught to see themselves as separate to all the rest, and to understand capitalism as in you make as much money as you can from all the rest, so those lower classes, they are just there for you to exploit. I mean, that's capitalism.
Yes.
But if you add nationalism to it, you say, well, those people are part of your family.
You involve everybody. Exactly.
Yeah.
You're quite right. I'm quite sure Cameron knew long before he was Prime Minister that he was going to be capable of being in a position of Prime Minister, leading a privileged life. And so, yeah, you're right, because he's probably stepping on people to get to that place, without even realising it sometimes, but because it doesn't include the whole country, only a section, and you've just hit the nail on the head.
Well, this is why, you know, the Jews liked to bring in all these different peoples into the country, because then it breaks up that sense of all being part of the same family.
Unity.
It breaks up the loyalty that you have to these people, and then they can encourage the rich to exploit the poor, and they can encourage
and bribe them to, yeah.
Yeah, and they can encourage the poor to rise up and fight the rich and break things apart, and then the Jew can come in and take everything like they do with communism, because they control both sides. They'll be whispering in the ear of the factory owner and also in the pub along with the workers, encouraging them to strike. And if you have a ethnically homogenous group and they've got a healthy sense of loyalty to one another and see each other as members of the same family, then they're going to work together. And that was the basis of National Socialism. That really ties in with this next quote here as well from Goebbels. He continues, 3 million people lack work and sustenance. The officials, it is true, work to conceal this misery. They speak of measures and silver linings. Things are getting steadily better for them and steadily worse for us. The illusion of freedom, peace and prosperity that we were promised when we wanted to take our fate in our own hands is vanishing. Only the complete collapse of our people can follow from these irresponsible policies. Thus, we demand the right of work and a decent living for every working German. So that's exactly that situation that you were pointing to there, Dennis. You've got one group with a lot of money that are talking about silver linings and things are going to get better, and then you've got a lot of people that aren't being talked about, that haven't got any jobs, they haven't got any homes, they're living on the breadline, and you've got a similar situation to today, I think.
I think as long as this system is in place, we always will have, because it's built on misery.
And he's saying, we demand the right of work and a decent living. And that was the thing. They said, well, it's every German's right to have a job. Now, how can you go about making it every German's right to have a job? Well, one of the first things you have to do is say that anybody who's not German, they've taken that job from somebody who's German. So they shouldn't have that. They should be encouraged to go back to their own country, basically, because they've taken something that isn't theirs. And this is... you know, this is a gripe I think that everybody has when they talk about the economy and they say, well, all these immigrants come in and they create jobs. They don't create those jobs, because if they weren't here, it would be British people that were doing those jobs. They haven't created anything. Yeah, they've lowered the wages, and they've taken those jobs away from the people whose right it was to create those jobs for themselves.
Well, they're not really jobs as such today, because you've got this, you know, this contract work, say for supermarkets, where, you know, they'll call you if they need you. So there's no, you may be classed as employed, but you're not really employed. It's a real whimsy way of being employed compared to what it used to be. When you had a job, you had a job. But not so much today.
Yeah, the 0 hours working, 0 hours contracts. You used to be able to have a job for life. You know, people would get a job in a factory, and they'd have a pension, they'd have their holidays, they'd have a club there, and they would have good wages. They would have double time on a Sunday, extra money for working nights, time and a half on a Saturday.
Yeah,
and they would be looked after.
It's a different feeling. You know, you've got this solid, secure feeling, even though it may not be as secure as you think, but, you know, at least you've got that, you know, well, I'm at work next week and I can afford this and I can afford this holiday.
So you can make plans. You can make plans then, and people can plan to have children, and they can work out what they're going to be earning, and they're safe and they're secure. And what they've done today is they've taken away all that security. And you're lucky if you've got a temping job nowadays, or you've got this zero hours contract thing, and they're not going to pay you sick pay, and they're not going to give you holidays. And because you've got other immigrants coming in, that keeps these prices down low. And they can always say, well, we can always get somebody else in.
And pensions are then pushed to even later in life. You know, everything gets squeezed. And by doing everything like that, suddenly somebody somewhere is getting richer.
And there's no actual right to have a job. There's no right to be employed. And one of the, you could say, well, okay, so you got rid of the foreigners so that there's more work. But what if there still isn't enough work? Well, if there isn't enough work, then you should be working to improve the country. The government should be setting out big infrastructure projects, which is what they did in Germany, and they built the autobahns.
To keep the nation busy.
Yeah. Railways, that's the most important thing, is that everybody in the nation's got to be kept productive, if they're capable of being productive,
and healthy,
obviously. Yeah, if they're healthy and they're capable of it, then they need to have these ways to earn for themselves and earn for the country as well. I'm getting
ambition as well. Yeah.
I'm getting some odd clippings, Dennis, on Skype there. Sometimes it's clipping a bit. I don't know if everything's plugged in well at your end, is it? You just want to check.
Yeah, I mean, I can hear a thing.
Okay, hopefully it will sort itself out. So he's talking about housing and employment and improving the lot of the German people, and also saying that there's another group there that are earning a lot of money out of all of this, and they're the ones that are talking about things are going to improve. If we just put up with how it is now, it's going to improve. But it didn't improve. And also, this is what Hitler was speaking about with this Dawes plan that you were talking about last week, Dennis, I think.
Yeah.
The fact they borrowed all this money, and it was just so that they could pay the interest. It wasn't so that they could invest in jobs and get people back to work. It was just so that they could pay the interest on the interest from before. And people were just getting poorer and poorer. And this is 1927.
Slow death, weren't it?
Yeah.
A silent assassin type thing, where you think everything should be working, but really you're just being deprived of your air.
Now, this is after Hitler came out from the prison, isn't it? Or is it while he was in there? Yeah. It's that first 2 years when he comes out.
Yeah.
Continuing here, while the front soldier was fighting in the trenches to defend his fatherland, some Eastern Jewish profiteer robbed him of his hearth and his home. The Jew lives in the palaces, and the proletarian, the front soldier, he lives in holes that do not even deserve to be called homes. This is neither necessary nor unavoidable, but rather an injustice that cries out to the heavens. A government that stands by and does nothing is useless. and must vanish, and the sooner the better. Therefore, we demand homes for German soldiers and workers. If there is not enough money to build them, then drive the foreigners out so that Germans can live on German soil. And you just think of how many houses they're saying need to be built today just to house the newcomers, just to house the foreigners that have come into the country. I mean, officially they say it's about 60%, but it's actually 100% when you think about it. Because if the British people aren't producing enough to replace themselves, so each two people is either producing none or just producing one, then there's already more than enough houses for them. We already couldn't fill the houses up with all the British people. There's no need to be building on the Greenbelt land. It's all for these foreigners. So there's nothing to be gained from it.
People can't afford it. The houses might be there. I mean, I watch these programs, you know, where they show people around 4 or 5 houses when they want to move out to, say, London, they want to go into the country, and the fabulous houses, but who can afford them? Apart from these people who just appear on TV every now and again, giving an illusion that everybody can afford them.
Well, when they say these are affordable housing, what they're saying is everything else is unaffordable. You often hear that, don't you? And how much affordable housing is going to be built on this estate? Well, that means everything else is unaffordable. And again, that means that in places like London that are very expensive, it's just filled with rich people from abroad that can buy houses people there. Everyone else rents. Yeah. And again, in the country, you've got a knock-on effect. In the country, you've got people that can't afford to live in places like rural Cornwall, been brought up there all their lives, because there are people from London that are moving there and buying up these second homes. And then
a two-tier system now.
Yeah, and there should be some subsidy to help the people that have lived there all their lives so that they can stay there. And you think,
in a nationalistic country, that would happen, I would imagine, automatically. But when you live in a country that doesn't believe in nationalism and will accept any rich Arab to buy any property, be it a football team or a house, then whatever happens naturally is not in the interest of a nationalist.
There's also a point here where it says here, but rather an injustice that cries out to the heavens. And I think the actual wording there was probably a sin crying out to heaven. And that's a Bible quote. There's a certain number of sins that are crying out to heaven, crying out to heaven for vengeance. And I think that, again, that shows you that Goebbels is well acquainted with the Bible there. And when they were talking about building these new homes, they were all going to be environmentally sustainable as well. Each one of these homes that they were going to build had a certain area of garden so that they could grow their own vegetables. And where you had natural resources that were being created in an area, they were going to build the processing plant for those resources in that area as well, and the homes for the people that were going to work there. And whatever was being processed and created there, that would be sold in that area. So they were trying to make everything self-sustainable. So,
well, that's opposite today, isn't it? Because it's against the law to grow some vegetables, I'm sure, and even to collect rainwater.
And also, Well, also you've got all these, all these travel miles. You've got something that, like, say you've got fish, which is caught in Grimsby. Then that goes over in a huge lorry over to Holland, where it's processed. And then it comes back in a lorry over to France, where it's put into little packets. And then it comes back to Britain to be sold on the supermarket shelves. So you've got from Grimsby, it's gone to Holland, Germany, France, and then back to Britain again. So you've got all that work.
And you're up for the cost.
Yeah, this is what I mean by what the Germans wanted to do was have all the processing plants at the same area where the fish is caught. So the fish are caught, it gets processed, get packaged, then they go out, and it's all done in that same area, which would create jobs for the area, basically, and mean that it was self-sustainable. And instead of having huge cities that couldn't be manageable, you would just have enough to cope with the work that was there. So you didn't have people commuting, and people would get used to the area that they're in.
Yeah, I've never liked the idea of these supermarkets. You know, they tend to close everything down of the small shopkeepers and drive everybody into this super. I mean, I think every town in Britain must have a Tesco. It just kills the natural environment, and all the money then is centralised into one supermarket or two if you've got an Asda. I've never liked the idea because it is kind of draining all the local resources for an international, if you like.
Well, I can remember reading that the Germans were trying to do something about that, and I can't remember if it's in Mein Kampf or one of the other books that they wrote, and they were saying that these Jews were basically doing the shops out of business and then bringing them all together into one, so you had like one big shop that sold everything. And the small German stallholders, they couldn't compete with it, and they would end up selling. And I think since then, I mean, I think we got our first big supermarkets in the 60s. But since then, that's just become normal now. And we've got a huge, great Tesco's, we've got a huge, great Sainsbury's, and everybody goes to these out-of-town areas where they have these big shops, and there's less and less small shops, and most of the corner shops now are run by Pakistanis and Indians.
Yeah, they've got their own world, haven't they?
Yeah.
You know, they sell their own food, and so that cuts us out again.
And they used to say that England was a nation of shopkeepers. And they're not a nation of shopkeepers anymore. It's been, they've been pushed out basically through this idea of capitalism and wanting to make as much money, and where the Indians were quite happy to open on a Sunday and open up on a Sunday night. They're the ones that made the more money out of it. I mean, that was one of the reasons that stopped Sunday.
I covered it in Communism by the Back Door, where double yellow lines played a big feature in all this, where they put a double yellow lines outside, you know, on the high street where people couldn't park. And if they had to park, they had to go to another area to pay. And then they built a supermarket with free car parking. And so that was another hammer nail in the coffin for the shopkeeper, who had to watch people go by who couldn't stop the car and buy any of the goods.
Yeah, I think those yellow lines they put up in the villages and the small towns, that's been the death of so many businesses.
Yeah.
People just want to stop off and pick their stuff up. And that's where everybody used to get the news from. And that's where you get a sense of community as well. You go to your local shops and you pick up on all the local gossip. And now you're told what to think and what the news is through the television. And it all used to be just through community gossip. How can you have community gossip if the community you live in speaks five different languages? You know, it must be horrible for these, you know, these elderly people in these towns that have become multicultural, and they go to their local shop, and that's, you know, that's the only interaction they have with other human beings, and it's all people talking a foreign language to them.
Well, they're building these smart cities as well, which I've yet to fully understand. I know there's a lot of surveillance goes on in them. I watched a program not too long back when people were watching the change of the guard outside Buckingham Palace, and everybody in that vicinity they've got certain mechanisms there where the phones are read if you're in that area. And so I'm not saying they read every phone, but they've got the capability of going back and reading it. And these smart cities are of a similar concept, I think, whereas surveillance keeps everybody in a way that the government would like. So that's even more of a hammer.
You know, when everybody believed in God, there was no need for surveillance, because everybody just assumed they were already under surveillance by God, and he was going to punish them if they did something wrong.
I saw an interesting quote the other day, actually, about that. It said, so on the lines, once you don't believe in God, you'll believe in anything, which is quite true.
And also, you think every office of authority is based on taking an oath. You know, these people take an oath. They took an oath to God to obey the Christian laws, and they're not going to be corrupt.
That's gone
then.
Now.
They're not going to take bribes. Take.
Law got in Europe, or UN. That's
take,
gone.
Take that belief out, and all those oaths that they take, they're hollow. You know, that's who are they frightened of punishing them anymore? They're not, because they've lost their belief in God. I mean, it was so central to everything to have that belief in God, and all the effort to try and compensate for God. They're never going to be able to compensate for it. Doesn't matter how many cameras they put up there trying to make sure people do as they tell them to. You know, it's not going to compensate for people doing it themselves. Yeah. You know, doing it with their conscience.
Man-made laws are easy to overturn, obviously. So they get rid of the God-made laws, and life gets even more generous for the upper class.
And how do they get rid of the God-made laws? They pretend they were just man-made laws, and the man-made laws are no different. So then they can overturn them. You know, that's part of it as well, isn't it? There's one other thing I wanted to point out there with this, and he's talking about the soldiers, and where the soldiers were away fighting, someone while he was back at home, the Eastern Jewish profiteer was robbing him of his hearth and home. Think about how our soldiers today are treated. You know, the majority of the homeless British people, I think, were originally in the armed forces, and you've got the British government, or you've got Theresa May's government, changing laws so that people that fought in Northern Ireland can be prosecuted. You got all these frivolous prosecutions against people that fought in Iraq, and the government's doing nothing about it. You've got veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder that are homeless. You've got veterans with missing limbs that have only got charities out there to look after them. You know, they're really not looking after the people that have fought for the country in the army, and they're mocking the army by putting out these adverts encouraging crybabies to join and Muslims to join and snowflakes to join. I mean, it must be so embarrassing to be in the army and see these adverts, these diversity friendly adverts that the government has put out. It shows a real contempt for these people that are prepared to lay down their lives for the country. You think the least that they could do is make sure that they've got a home when they come back, and that they're not homeless, but the government just doesn't seem interested. And this was obviously, this was an issue back then in Germany, and the NSDAP, they made that a central point. You know, you've got to look after our ex-soldiers. They've got to be given homes.
Well, it's always amused me how nationalism is looked on in peacetime, which is not very highly, and how nationalistic the government will want us to be if ever there's a war. If all of a sudden, you know, you've got to go and fight for your country. And it's something which a lot of people today aren't used to anyway, because nationalism is frowned on.
It's a double standard. And nationalism is the natural position. It's just the extension of how you feel about your family to your
middle
nation,
ground.
To your race. It's absolutely natural. And if you talk to people about it, I mean, if you don't use the word nationalism, you just explain what it is, you know, they'll say, well, that's wonderful. Isn't that the way everybody is supposed to be? And you can say, well, no, apparently not. Because, you know,
propaganda has told us otherwise.
Yeah. You're supposed to just be looking out for your own interests and not be concerned about
number one,
anybody else. Continuing here, he says, our people are growing and others are diminishing. It will mean the end of our history if a cowardly and lazy policy takes from us the posterity that will one day be called to fulfill our historical mission. Therefore, we demand land on which to grow the grain that will feed our children. And I think there's two points here that he's making. Number one, he's encouraging new births. And also, you could look at that and say there's a cowardly and lazy policy that wants to take our posterity from us. That could be the abortion agenda and the promotion of abortion. But he's saying we need to produce more children. If we have more children, we need more food. If we're going to have more food, we need more land on which to grow the grain that will feed our children.
Do you know, a thought just crossed my mind. As he's reading this, if he could see what Merkel was bringing in, still bringing in, he'd have an heart attack. To see all those black immigrants piling into Germany while he's giving this speech at the time, it just beggars belief.
Although the whole policy now is just to replace people, is demographic replacement. Just replace the electorate entirely. That just seems to be this policy that they have. But this idea of we've got to have land on which to grow the grain to feed our children. I mean, that was the reason for colonizing the New World in the first place. That was the reason for going to America. That was the reason for going to Australia, Canada. It was because they knew that we were going to need more land, because we're going to have more children in the future. They're all going to need to eat. They're all going to need their own space. And that was why people gave their lives and took those huge risks and went out like pioneers and fought the Indians and built those cities and those civilizations. And that inheritance, because that's what it is, it's our inheritance, the people in power have given that away to other people. And these other people now think it's their inheritance. You've got that... Cortez woman, that brown Cortez woman in America saying, "Oh, my father told me that all of this was ours. It belongs to everybody." No, it doesn't.
The natural way of life is that the strong will always overcome the weak, which is what you've just been talking about. Strong nations are going out there and reaping the benefits, but that's a natural order. And what we've got now is an unnatural order where the weakest are getting the treatment over the strongest, which is just goes against everything in nature.
With the help of the strongest, that's the thing. They wouldn't be able to do it normally, but they've managed to. I mean, it's not even them. This is why you can see that, it can't be these low IQ Negroes and these Mexicans and Muslims. It's not them that have manipulated white people to do this. It's this other group that we've had with us for the last thousand years that have done that.
Yeah, the third behind the scene, behind the curtains.
Yeah, the fifth column, the people that aren't actually needed, that don't actually produce anything, and it's to their benefit for things to be this way. It's to their benefit for everyone to not have any racial or loyalty to anybody else.
That's when they thrive. That's it. You hit the nail on the head.
But this, this going out there to conquer these new lands and so that we had the resources for our children, that's what people should be saying to these immigrants when they say, "Oh, well, America is ours. This is all for us. No, it isn't. It was needed for us. It was left to us by the people that went out there and colonized it. And that's what it means by our posterity in the Constitution. It says for our posterity. And that's what it means. The descendants of the people that wrote that constitution. It's got nothing to do with Negroes that have, pouring into the country through the southern border or Mexicans. It's got nothing to do with them. It can only apply to white people. And that is really just common sense. And what the Germans were doing here is they're saying, we want to be self-sufficient. We want more agriculture and we want to be eating German beef and German lamb and German corn and German wheat. We don't want to be importing it. And that's,
except for us, isn't it?
Yeah.
We want to buy a British, but that's gone.
And this fits in with, the environmental movement. The environmental movement will say, well, you need to be self-sufficient in your home. You want to grow your own vegetables and be as self-sufficient as you can at home. But then they don't apply that to the nation. They don't say, well, the nation should be self-sufficient as well and should try to decouple itself from global trade and produce enough for itself, because we can't produce enough for ourselves anymore because we've imported so many foreigners. And there are so many people living on the island now that it couldn't be self-sufficient. And that's because of all these foreigners that have been imported. So once again, if you were to deport the foreigners, Britain could be self-sufficient and, we wouldn't have this hold over us from these other countries because we're all tied in with them with global trade. This is why Russia succeeds, because Russia is pretty much totally self-sufficient. So it doesn't really matter what sanctions America puts on Russia. It doesn't matter to them because they can produce themselves.
They won't allow a minority to influence anything of the culture. They're welcome to come, but you've got your place. Where in our situation, you're welcome to come and take over. That's the problem.
Yeah, that's the difference there. Well, Goebbels continues, while we dreamed and chased strange and unreachable fantasies, and, that's what diversity is, that's what multiculturalism is, it's a strange and unreachable fantasy, Others stole our property. Today, some say this was an act of God. Not so. Money was transferred from the pockets of the poor to the pockets of the rich. That is cheating. Shameless, vile cheating. A government presides over this misery that, in the interests of peace and order, one cannot really discuss. And what he's saying there is we don't want a violent revolution against them. We leave it to others to judge whether it represents Germany's interests or those of our capitalist tormentors. We, however, demand a government of national labour, statesmen who are men, and whose aim is the creation of a German state. And that's what a state should be. It should be made up of the people that it is governing, and their sole aim should be the improvement and betterment of the people that they represent. And that's all that a state is. Adolf Hitler goes into great detail of what a real state should be and what it and the reason for having it. And I'm amazed at how close that is to what's going on today, you know, where he says we dreamed and chased strange and unreachable fantasies while others were stealing our property. And that is exactly what we've got today, this utopian idea. It's an unreachable fantasy. And one
lack of men as well, real men, what I call real men.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a lack of it. I mean, I can watch certain things on TV and somebody will be talking and something will just trigger me up and I'll think, this man would never go over a wall if he had the opportunity to. Is he capable of going over a wall? Because he's not a man.
There's one thing you can say about Boris Johnson. He is masculine. He's not like David Cameron.
And they come from the same cloth. That's the weird thing about it.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see there. Well, we got a final bit here from Goebbels. He says, these days, anyone has the right to speak in Germany. The Jew, the Frenchman, the Englishman, the League of Nations, the conscience of the world, and the devil knows who else. Everyone but the German worker. He has to shut up and work. Every 4 years, he elects a new set of torturers, and everything stays the same. That is unjust.
I've noticed that line.
Yeah, unjust and treasonous. We need tolerate it no longer. We have the right to demand that only Germans who build this state may speak. Those whose fate is bound to the fate of their fatherland. Therefore, we demand the destruction of the system of exploitation. Up with the German workers' state, Germany, for the Germans. So he's been really quite clear there, and it is just common sense, really. The people that built the state, they should be the ones that speak for the state, and only they should be the ones that have a say in it, because it's only them whose fate is bound up with it, because it's their fathers that are buried in the soil of that land. We can't just get up and go. You know, foreigners that have come here can, but we can't do that. Our ancestors were buried in this soil here, and our lives have been
the German women and politicians in the recent years, when they're saying that the German race will not be the same, and they're quite proud saying it, and they're probably white and blonde, these politicians, and they want to see the end of that particular strain. So it's sad. It's sad, but unfortunately, that's the way of the world at the moment.
Well, they've conned people into thinking that the unity that people have and the bonds that people have that build up a nation are just something on paper. It's just a shared ideals or a bit of paper that says that you're a citizen. They managed to con people into forgetting that. You know, the nation is built up of shared blood. It's built up of shared ancestry, shared ethnicity. That's what the nation is, and we've been conned into thinking that it's something different. I even Gaddafi knew this. I can remember reading in his Green Book where he said this idea that the state is built up of shared ideals is a fantasy. Nobody goes to war to fight for shared ideals. They go to war to fight to save their people. It's like, you know, you would fight to save your family. You would fight to the death to save your family. You wouldn't fight to the death for some obscure idea of human rights or capitalism or communism. And that's one of the reasons why they don't want people to discover nationalism, because they know that it's inspiring and it guides your whole life. And this is something else I was thinking about the other day. What we have here, Dennis, is a creed. It's an ideology and a belief that is central to everything that we do. And they are not allowed to discriminate against creeds. You know, they always use that word creed in the legislation that they use. No, race, religion, or creed will be discriminated against. And what we have is most definitely a creed.
I saw some interesting brainwashing this week, believe it or not, whereas a child refused to go out into the fields without sunscreen. So he's been taught at school that it's dangerous to go out in the sun, and he won't go out in the fields without sunscreen.
Well, he may have very light skin or something, maybe ginger.
No, that's everybody in the school's been taught this. And everyone. You notice on the news, well, you notice on the news how people are making a big thing of these hot days. I mean, somebody was talking about an old people's home where they had to close the curtains because the sunlight was shining through. And it's just a brainwashing, what I've noticed recently. It's got ridiculous.
Well, the more it gets ridiculous like that, the more people are going to wake up and realise it. That's why I say that, you know, the best propaganda we have is the BBC and the mainstream media. And the worse they get, you know, the more people are going to wake up and start looking for the people that are speaking the truth. And then they're going to find Radio Aryan and they're going to find us. Well, Dennis. Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Dennis.
No problem.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.
To Radio Aryan.